Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the pothole in my tarmac. Oh, that's another great one there, Dave, isn't it?
How are you?
Very good. Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. So how's it going then, Dave?
I'm very good, thank you, Mr. Plato. Yourself?
Yes, on top form, actually. Looking forward to today.
Yeah, so am I, because we have a very, very special guest. A gentleman, in fact, who we've been trying to source for this performance for some time, actually.
You know, we're now into
your gentleman. Don't go down that road again. That's a joke from another thing. But anyway, I think you need to, without further ado, introduce our gentleman guest today.
Well, our guest today is a TV presenter, a journalist who may just have about the best job in the world. He's known for being quite fond of cars, bikes, and all sorts of weird and wonderful machines in general. And that's why we've booked him for this show. It is, of course, the one and only Mr. James May. Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you? What a very nice introduction. I liked the gentleman bit as well. I thought, ooh, they're going to go a bit too far with this.
Do you know what it was, in all seriousness, is that we recorded one of these the other day, and the word gentleman was in the title. And yeah. Jason said gentleman, and then I said gentleman. And then we just kept saying gentleman lots and lots and lots. So it's become a bit of an in-joke. So anyway, but you genuinely are a gentleman guest of ours, and we're very pleased to have you along for the ride. And my first question to both of you, obviously you two know each other from old. Where did your paths first cross? Was it Driven, or did you know each other before that?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Yeah, I think did you do Driven starting about 98-ish, James?
I did series one of Driven with the other Jason and Mike Brewer.
Yeah.
But I only did it for one series because after that I got fired like I did from everything else.
Did you? Well, I must have jumped in your shoes then.
I think you did. Well, actually, yeah. I think Penny Mallory officially took my place.
And then I must have taken Jason's because he went to... Did he go to Top Gear, I think, by memory?
He went to Top Gear, but he didn't go straight away. So I think you may have been one season late. I think they got you in because you could drive. You could definitely drive things, whereas we could just talk bollocks about them, to be honest. But I can tell you the story behind this now because a long time has passed. But we did one series that was, you know, I did watch a bit of it the other day for the first time in many, many years. And it's quite good. We came up with a few quite... original ideas like the three-header group test and the news section inside the truck, you know, all stuff you would have done as well. And that, you know, those were ideas that, shall we say, reappeared elsewhere. But after series one, they decided this was an early bit of wokeness. They thought, well, this program is not quite right because it's got three white blokes all the same age.
Really? Do you think?
No, they really? Told me they needed a woman. They needed to have a woman. So, they couldn't really get rid of Mike Brewer because he had his other shows and he was very popular. They couldn't really get rid of Jason because he was, you know, being groomed for greater things and he was going to become the editor of Car Magazine and all the rest of it. So the only target left was me. So I was out the door and that was that, really.
Well, I didn't know that.
But I got fired from everything in the old days, so, you know, I was used to it.
Well, funny enough, you mentioned you saw some old clips. I saw some last night. They just appeared on my Twitter feed. And I think it was show one of series one with you. I think it was in a Subaru with Brewer. I think you were in a BMW.
Yes, that's right. That's the one I saw. I didn't watch the whole thing because I was cringing. But I was in the then new 3 series.
Yeah.
And there was the Subaru and the Audi.
Yeah, it was a good little item. Yeah. 30 years ago, isn't it? Best part,
well, not quite. Yeah. 1998, I think. It's a long time ago.
It's
the colour's all different, isn't it? I mean, mainly because it was fashionable to wear autumnal hues, I think, before the fashion industry. So we all look a bit beige, or I look a bit beige anyway. And I've got very short hair and a slightly sort of puffy baby face, and I'm sounding ever so enthusiastic about being on television, you know, because
that's what it was like though, wasn't it, in the early days? We'd over present and like be a bit overly keen.
Yes you would, and the sort of the ways of making it were slightly different, so the camera would sort of, the car would go round. Did you notice the car would go upside down because they'd obviously got a new gadget that made the tracking camera rotate, so they'd use it a lot. And then, you know, the camera would come through the window and you'd go, well, whatever Jason's saying is rubbish because I'm in the new BMW M3 and you know what that means. I was like, oh, God, you idiot. How did you ever get a job?
And do you remember how big the kit was? The cameras were massive, weren't they?
Yeah, the cameras were massive and the cameras in the car. Now, this is interesting. I was talking, this is not interesting for your listeners, but it's interesting for us. I was talking to someone the other day about the in-car minicam. So they went from being quite massive to being really quite small camera heads about the size of a GoPro.
Yeah.
Then you had a separate little light that always rattled with French flag. It looked like something from World War II. It was made of you know, grey painted tin. But then they fell out of fashion as the cards came in to replace the tapes. And now when we're doing Grand Tour, we have these massive, effectively SLR cameras, but movie spec.
Yeah.
Stuck onto the windscreen, and about 25 to 30% of your forward vision is obscured by those cameras. It scares the shit out of me. Yeah. One day there's going to be like a woman with a pram exactly in line with the camera, and I'll go off saying, and here I am driving the... Oh, dear.
But I just find it terrifying, though. As you say, you know, that was 1998, which in my mind and in my world isn't that long ago. But it's the fact that then you work it out, and it's 25 years ago. Because for me, and I'm sure we're all the same, is that... The noughties, I hate the term for that decade, but anyway, the early 2000s just seemed to go, and then the 2010s just seemed to go, and here we find ourselves in the 20s. But there was somebody pointed this out the other day to me as a sort of stat, and it terrified me, is that we are now as far away from the year 2000 as 1977 was. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, God, yes.
Which is a horrible and terrifying thought when you think about the year 2000 doesn't seem that long ago. I remember the Millennium Bug, and I remember where I was on New Year's Eve 1990 to 2000.
I have a very, very clear memory of New Year's Eve 1999 with my then girlfriend, and we went to various things. We went up to see the fireworks and things from Parliament Square. I can remember all sorts of details about that, but then it becomes the noughties or the nunnies or whatever we're going to call them.
Yeah.
And everything from then till now is, there are no distinct events in it for me.
No.
It's all the same thing. It's just like a big minestrone of stuff going on. But when you say, it's a very interesting stat that this is as far from 2000 as 2000 was from 1977. Does that mean looking back from now at 2000 is as horrible as 1970 when we were in 2000, because that's terrible if it is.
It just scares me, the fact that the years are just racing by. But anyway, we're sounding possibly borderline old at the moment, aren't we? So
yes.
I'll bring it down a bit.
Yeah, but you get back to the youth culture.
I'll bring it down. I can remember 99 being with a few pals, and it was the New Year's Eve, and we were in the town square in Chamonix, and somehow we blagged ourselves up to the first floor of this amazing bit building with huge, great, big kind of palatial outside windows, but then there was a balcony which ran all the way around the outside. So like a lovely old, I guess there'd be like Georgian here, but whatever they are over there. And me and a few mates got out, and we thought, well, let's start a snowball fight. So we got some snow and started throwing it down. Well, the whole town square turned on us. And they put all the windows through.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we somehow managed to get away with it. But that's what I distinctly remember about the turn of the millennium, was all the windows coming in this amazing place, this bar, restaurant type thing.
Oh, you see, most of us just had quite a nice time. We didn't go abroad and smash the place up.
Well,
get involved in some international incident, Jason.
Well, I mean, we just threw an innocent one or two snowballs and it backfired badly.
That would be called escalation these days. I don't think we used that word back then, but...
No, I think you. I remember. I was actually back home by midnight with my missus at the time, who had had too much to drink, and so I had to carry her back. And then on that evening, for some reason, and I don't know why they went down this road, they did a special of the big breakfast, but it was on in the evening. They did like a sort of late night one with Johnny Vaughan and Denise Van Outen, and I ended up being back there with a can of lager, watching this on my own, thinking, well, this is shit, isn't it? You know, this is like the dawn of a new millennium. I mean, I'm really thoroughly underwhelmed so far.
New Year's Eve is often disappointing, though, isn't it?
It is.
Everybody says that. And that one was just particularly bad for you. Your particularly bad one. Mine was in about 1982, but your bad one just happened to coincide with the new millennium. It's bad luck, but yeah, there it is. Can of lager, big breakfast. Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty shit. Actually,
Mrs. Starfaced on the bed.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway, we are sounding a bit old. Let's talk about something that happened in 2008.
So, James, Top Gear Grand Tour, without giving obviously anything away, that's what, you know, we all know and love you for. But is it, you know, is that chapter closed for you?
No.
You guys now, or now that the big man has gone off and ploughing fields badly, or is there still going to be stuff to do?
Well, I mean, I'm being perfectly honest with you now, because there's nothing to hide, but we don't often think more than about a year in advance, because let's face it, we're old, so you can't. So, I mean, we've got another one about to come out. We've just filmed another one a few weeks ago, and we've got another one planned to film later on this year. So, and what happens after that, I don't know. That's a bit of a grey fog, but it always is. Jeremy is ploughing his farm. I've been cooking, doing some travel. Hammond's taking his own cars apart and failing to put them back together. It's not over.
Yeah.
It's not over, but we're probably nearer the end than the beginning. Oh, God, let's hope so. We don't want another 20 years of this. Otherwise, that's I'll be sitting saying, oh, you know, it was only 2023, and that's as long ago now as 2000 was from 2023.
Oh, well, that's good news.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because I was worried that, you know, obviously events of late might have sort of put a full stop on that. But actually, I'm pleased that it's carrying on, as will many, many people. In terms of Top Gear, as we said, obviously, as James said, what you're arguably best known for, am I right in thinking, are the best memories for you the overseas adventures and the specials that you did? Are those the memories that you hold most dear?
Yes, despite what I said earlier about it all being a big soup, there are bits that stand out in particular. I mean, the most amazing thing about it is all the places I've been to and seen that I would never have been to and seen otherwise. I mean, when I was younger, I did travel a bit. I used to travel around on my own, but to be honest, I would do things like go cycling or on nice train journeys through Europe. And once or twice I went to the US, to California and New York. But as a result of the TV job, you know, I've been to the magnetic North Pole across various deserts. I've been to Japan 8 or 9 times and so on. And I just don't think that would have happened otherwise. So the memories are, I mean, the past has gone. I've often said that in a very cynical way, but in a sense it hasn't gone, because they must have made a difference to the person I am now, in the same way that, excuse me, I'm coughing, in the same way that what you eat and where you live does, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I've always said that if it ends tomorrow, I don't mean because I die, I mean because, you know, I'm cancelled or fired again or whatever. You know, the only truly magnanimous thing to do would be to say, well, that was good, wasn't it? And I was very lucky. You can't really complain and go, oh, for God's sake. You know, because just 1 week of it is pretty good. 20 years is a bit of a steal. I'm amazed we've got away with it, but there you go.
Don't Where was the weirdest place you would say you'd been? I mean, did you ever go to North Korea or anything like that?
I've not been to North Korea, no. I've been to some remote bits of Russia, which were pretty weird, places like Nizhny Novgorod and some other place up in Siberia. I've been to Mongolia, which is not, I mean, it's not weird, it's just, well, it's empty.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. But it's again, it's a place. No, I would never have thought, where shall I go?
Mongolia. Yeah.
I have to go to Mongolia. But we did end up driving across Mongolia, and it was incredible, really. So that one stands out. The magnetic North Pole stands out. Because, to be honest, I didn't like it. I don't like snow.
Yeah.
I don't particularly like cold. And as I said at the time, I don't like noisy technical clothing with Velcro on it, because it's annoying. And people used to say, what's it like? What's it like going to the North Pole? That must be amazing. And I said, no, go home, open the fridge, kneel down and stick your head in the icebox and stay there for 3 weeks. Then you'll know exactly what it's like. Okay, that's the view. That's the sensation. That's all there is to it. You don't come across, you don't come across a town, obviously, or a bar, or even a colour other than white. You know?
Yeah.
It's not really that. And when you get to the North Pole, or the magnetic North Pole, as we went to, there's there's nothing there either. You sort of, you instinctively think, well, there's got to be a visitor's centre or a gift shop.
There's not even there like a pile of bricks and then nothing.
No, nothing. Not even a can of snowballs. You just get there and the sat nav goes a bit, he goes a bit mad because he doesn't know where it is. Everything is south from there, obviously. Yeah, it's not like Stonehenge at all. There's no druids, no cars. Yeah.
Stonehenge at least has got an underpass, hasn't it, underneath the road and a gift shop and everything, and probably a cafe.
You've got all sorts of things at Stonehenge. Yeah. You can have a party there. It's great. But the North Pole, there was nobody there.
Right, I'm striking that off the list then. Fuck
I would take that off the list. Yeah.
Take that off the list. I mean, the thing that I used to sort of really enjoy about, you know, watching the specials over the years was the fact that obviously, you know, plans were in place for the trip as a whole and extensive plans, no doubt. And we had Richard Porter on here recently as well. And we were talking a little bit about that, but it's just the fact that obviously certain things will naturally go wrong and cars will go wrong and all these different things. So often the best laid plans will then have to be ripped up. And I would imagine that's all quite exciting when you're almost trying to work out a plan for the next day based upon the fact that what you'd intended to do and where you'd intended to go was now completely not possible.
Yes, there is quite a lot of that. It's one of those weird, it's a slight conundrum because you sort of feel if you take three blokes who have been working together for a long time and understand each other and have to, you know how to sort of bounce off each other, then you should just be able to put them in a car, you know, in three cars, say at one side of the middle of Africa with the job of driving across to the other side. And as we sometimes say in TV, the universe will provide. Of course, if you do a thing like that, it's going to be an adventure and things will happen. But you still make a plan because somehow if you didn't make a plan, they wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Part of them happening is them not going according to plan. But that can't happen if there is no plan, if you see what I mean. That's like Russell's paradox or something. But it's quite a lot of the show ends up being, stuff that just happened and, you know, it's not scripted in the true sense. So it's just what happened and what we said. That's it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that often produces the best moments, though, doesn't it?
Oh, I think our best moments have been unexpected and ad lib. Yeah. Definitely. It's down to the editor. I mean, that poor sod to find it, because make a 1.5 hour special,
how many tapes?
Specials are, well, it's,
cards. How many cards? Hundreds.
Because we've got, say, generally sort of between 12 and 14 days filming, there are three main camera crews plus a drone crew plus three or sometimes four mini cams per car plus effects cameras on the outside of the car to get some of that action. And most of them are running most of the time. So it's, I mean, the yield in TV is famously poor. You film all this stuff and then you get like 10 seconds at the end. It must be particularly bad for us, but some poor sods actually got to watch it all. I wouldn't even want to watch me, you know.
Not just my bit. Two.
Yeah, I quite like my bit, you know. I watch theirs as well. God.
But also, presumably, you know, when, again, with the dynamic with the three of you knowing each other so well, I would hazard a guess that for the most part, when you came over as being pissed off with each other or you came over as being absolutely falling about laughing at each other, that was all real, wasn't it? You know, I mean, I would imagine
pissed off is definitely real.
The pissed off was definitely real. Yeah, absolutely. When they've kind of messed around with your car or they've done this or they've hidden that or whatever, you know, that was all natural, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes. The truth is we're not actors and there are times when we've tried to sort of act bits and you think, oh dear, we better just quietly throw that away because it's pure cheese.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're not actors. We're just car journalists, really, who happen to have been put on. Well, you know what I mean, Jason. It starts with the subject. It doesn't start with a particular presenting or acting skill.
I know exactly what you mean about trying to act. So, some directors will kind of overproduce you and they get you to do something. God, it feels awful, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And actually, when you then go, well, can I just have a look at that? Thanks. You just want to pull the card out and throw it away because it is just cheesy, isn't it?
Yeah. And when they say, can you be angry about this? And I think, well, I'm not angry. not angry. Yeah. I'm actually finding it quite amusing. So, I can't. How do you pretend to be angry? This is what makes you realize that acting is actually a great skill.
Yes.
It's bloody difficult.
Yeah, definitely harder than you think.
Another little project you're onto is this book, Little Experts. And I must say, I've had a quick browse through it, and it's brought back tons of ace memories. Like, I can remember going to the States when I was probably 8, 9 years old and going to a rollerblade park. with the disc. I can remember that and that. But also I can remember, you know, there's that set section on building your go-kart.
Yes.
God, I can remember. The first thing I did was I looked at my knees and I've seen some of the old scars for some of the shunts. It's a great little book. Tell us a bit more about it, James.
Well, it's about, I mean, to be honest, when they approached me, they've done a whole series. So there's ones about the human body, money, the environment, animals.
Because Deborah Meaden's done one, hasn't she? And
yeah, Deborah Meaden's done the money one, which is great, actually. I could learn some stuff about that because I'm notoriously very poor with money. But they started off wanting me to do sort of vehicles in general. And I said, well, that's a massive subject. How about human-powered ones? Because there's the obvious ones like bicycles and pedal cars. But then there's some odd stuff like, you know, human-powered aeroplanes and submarines and so on. So that's what we made it. And I know what you mean about go-karts, because when I was writing that bit, I thought, God, yeah, me and my mate Cookie, we spent hours believing that we were almost like Formula One designers. And we would, they were just planks of wood and nails, obviously. Yeah. But, you know, we thought it was all very special. But you could never find the bloody wheels. Wheels were always so difficult to get hold of.
Yeah.
And if you heard of somebody that had an old pram, you think somebody's got an old pram, we'll have the wheels. And we go running around there and you'd find this thing in the garden all buckled and completely useless. wheels were like a currency.
Yeah, gold dust. Especially if you get a pair that matched.
Yeah, highly unlikely.
The same circumference,
There are a lot of go-karts going around, very designed for left-hand bends sort of thing.
Well, do you know what? I presented the one of the first Red Bull soapbox races Roundgate Park in Leeds way back when. And I'll tell you what, it was one of the best days ever because there's these absolute fruitcakes who have just designed the most danger they can into this thing. And the shunts they had, there was teeth hanging out, there was faces off, but they just loved it. And their creations were great.
Mm. It can be catastrophically dangerous. I mean, I'm amazed that we had a couple of courses for these various homemade carts and bicycles, because we used to put bicycles together out of bits and do things like put a chopper front wheel on a racing bike frame to see what would happen. Yeah. And there were a couple of routes. So there was one off-road route through there was sort of parkland, but it wasn't a formal park. So there was effectively the off-road course through there. But then on the nearby housing estate, there were various straight bits. And there was one bit that had, I mean, it was basically, the housing estate was laid out pretty much on a grid pattern. You know, it was a 70s type housing estate. But there was one bend in it that went downhill and had a pronounced left-hander with a camber on it, cambered the correct way.
Ooh,
and
nice.
it was known locally as the Fabulous Bend, because that's where you went to test out your new bike tyres. The people who actually lived on it must have been so pissed off with us.
Yeah.
But I am amazed, because it was quite steep as well. Nobody ever, I mean, there were sort of bruises and scrapes and maybe the odd broken collarbone, but I don't think anybody was seriously hurt. I mean, if you looked at it now, you'd think, well, you can't do that because you're going to get run over by a car coming. Yeah. You're going to get run over by a Mark I Granada coming the other way around the bend. But nobody worried. We didn't even put anybody at the end to keep a lookout. You just went flying down there and everybody survived.
Yeah,
better
absolutely.
Times they were back then.
They
better
were, though, weren't they?
For being a kid to have fun.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do anything now, and the kids aren't allowed to play Conkers, and they're not allowed to do this, and not allowed to do that.
Are they
that,
really not allowed to play Conkers?
Well, that might be an exaggeration, but I know that certainly, you know, there was people that was against it a few years ago. So, you know,
I know you're not allowed to use Japanese throwing stars in the playground anymore. I know that's definitely not on. Although all those nunchucks, you can't use those anymore. I can remember those being at my school. Some ruffian had those.
I must admit, I mean, we're straying into old fart conversation again, but some years, I mean, this is early thousands again, but I live quite near Ravenscourt Park in West London, and I was walking through there with a mate, and there are some massive, what I'd call conker trees, and the floor underneath them was just littered in conkers. And I thought, something very strange has happened, because when I was 10, you'd have been knocking the conkers down before they were ready. You know, you'd be there with a stick or something, trying to get them down. But now they're just lying on the floor rotting, and nobody wants the conkers. Nobody wants that joy of finding one.
A belter.
That's still in the shell, but it's just about to open. You put your fingernail in, and as it comes open, for about half a minute, the conker is really shiny.
Yes.
And then it goes off, it turns sort of matte. But in that initial moment, it's sort of oiled. And it's a thing of intense beauty and excitement.
Like an oiled cricket bat.
That's lost.
And you dip them in vinegar and bake them in the oven and all sorts of stuff to make them rock hard.
And then you tie a special type of knot. And then some people would put, this is because their dads worked in engineering or something, they'd put the string through, but rather than just put the string through and tie the knot, they'd put the string through and then thread a washer.
Oh.
See, I think that representation to the International Referees of Conquering.
It's cheating,
that,
isn't it?
That is not right.
I think that was Adrian Newey's young lad.
I really, probably. I mean, it's good thinking from an engineering point of view, but it's not in the spirit of the sport, which is that the conquer breaks and a bit hits you in the eye. Absolutely. That's how it works.
Absolutely. From conquers to cars, I think we need to get back onto the car history, Mr. James May. So take us back to the very beginning, if you will. What are your earliest memories of motor cars? Did it stem from your dad? Was it a family thing?
I think the very earliest memory of a car that I have was from the age of, I must have been under three because my younger brother had just been born and he's sort of 2¾ years younger than me.
Yeah.
And my dad at that point had a Morris 8 from the late 1930s. That was the only car he could afford. And he'd had it as a student and, you know, rebuilt it. And there was, it had leather seats, obviously, because everything did in those days. And they were green because everything was green or brown in Britain in the olden days. And the back seat had a little hole in it. And when I was sitting in the back, obviously we didn't have child seats or anything. I'd be sitting in the back with my mum, but I'd put my finger in this little hole. And I know it sounds slightly pervy, but even to this day, if I sit and think about it, I can still feel the sensation of that ragged, leathery hole on my left index finger. I can remember the sensation, which is odd because sensation, you know, touch sensations are quite difficult to recall. Yeah. But that one is absolutely clear. So that was the first car memory. And then after that, we had a Mark One console, which is the one that sort of looks a little bit like a Chevy Bel Air. You know, it's that sort of Americana shaped Ford.
Yeah.
And then we had that one didn't last very long. And then we had a Cortina Mark One, RVX 448D. That was the first car whose number plate I learned, and I've known them all since. Right?
Can I just pause you? Can I just pause you for a second, James? Right? Because this is a constant thread. Because Jason finds it weird that I know the registration plate of every car that I have ever had, or indeed ever been involved with. So I count all of my dad's cars as well, back to the age of about 4 or 5. Every single one. He thinks that almost like I'm some kind of, you know, I must be on some kind of special Rain Man spectrum. But I think it's quite normal when you're into cars to remember those.
I think it is. But the weird thing, I've had this conversation with Jeremy Clarkson because he suffers the same affliction. I don't remember the registration numbers of my cars so well. One or two I can, but all of my mum and dad's cars from a
Zerli,
not the Morris A because I probably couldn't read then. And we only had the console for a few months before it went for scrap. But from the Mark One Cortina, RVX 448D, which was replaced with the Mark III Cortina 2-litre GXL MWB 959K. So I know all my dad's registration numbers. And then MWB 416M, which was another console GT. And so
isn't it amazing that there is a little area in your mind which has got a little reservation sticker on it, and that's where you put those registration numbers.
Your dad's isn't that
amazing?
Registration.
But it is. It's even more amazing though. And you know, when you think about it, at the end of the day, this is just some kind of registration mark, and it could be anything, right? Just to determine that vehicle from that vehicle. But why should we be able to record that? You know, it's not something memorable. It's not a name. It's just a collection of digits and things. But maybe it's because, I don't know, maybe it's because the cars were so important to us.
I think that's it. Yeah. A, the cars were very important. Your dad's car was the best car in the world. It didn't matter what it was. It was, you know, it was an exciting thing. Mm. The second is those registration numbers became, they're not letters and numbers anymore. They're almost like very short form poetry or little ditties or maxims. So when I remember, like, my mother's Vauxhall was RAK 30R or RAC 30R.
Yeah.
It's not, it's, I it's I have to think what they are actually are as letters and numbers. It's more it's more like these days you'd call it a meme, I suppose,
or something
like that. KKY522P was my mum's 2CV, and that's a little poem. KKY522P.
I suppose actually because they're a lot shorter, they're a bit easier to recall, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, they're noises, aren't they?
Well, do you know, and it's funny, and this is, sorry, this is...
God, aren't we dull?
Sorry, I'm about to take it even duller, because it's in the same sort of way, and this is showing our age, is remember with the old-fashioned telephones, with the dial, in many ways, and it's sort of, you just reminded me of it there, James, when you were talking, is that I could sort of remember my phone number almost by the noises as opposed to the thing, right? So it was 5228333, so, and then you'd have sort of long ones and then short ones, and... You know, that's how you remembered things, because it was like a little noise.
It was, and you're dead right that with numbers with a lot of low numbers in, when you rotated the dial, it would wear your fingers out more. Yeah. But it took. I mean, I when we made the reassembler program where I put things back together, one of the things I did was an early Bakelite dial telephone. Mm. And the thing, I mean, I can sort of dimly remember those from kids, and I can definitely remember the bright plastic coloured ones with dials, which is what we had at home before the trim phone came out. You know.
Oh, yes, you remember that. It was a beauty, wasn't it, the trim phone?
But when you turned the dial and then you took your finger out, and it, by modern standards, it took an eternity for the thing, because it sort of went back to the beginning. And it's incredible, really.
Did you ever learn the trick of how to get a free telephone calls out of a public phone box, which had a dial on it?
Where
you tap it out.
Yeah,
and he never asked for your 2p.
No, that was fantastic discovering that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But sometimes the operator would be listening and knew you were doing it. Did you ever get that? So you'd have
the receiver
to your ear and you'd be going ding, 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 and then this voice would go, I know what you're doing.
No way. I suppose that was some lady in a little box with a load of wires and plugs, I guess.
I mean, the operator, I presume there aren't operators anymore, are there?
No. Wouldn't have thought
so. What a strange job.
Isn't it? You know, and I always used to think of them because in the cartoons and stuff, they used to plug things into like a jack field, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember her name?
No, she never told.
Rosemary.
Rosemary.
was it Kung Fu?
Was it? Oh, I can't remember. Rosemary the
Hello,
Hong Kong Fooey. It was with Rosemary the telephone operator. We might be potentially going down a little cul-de-sac here. So back to you, James. First car, then. What was the first car that you ever had? And do you remember passing your driving test?
I do remember. Actually, I don't remember passing the driving test, but I remember about an hour later when my mother said, I did it in her car, which was a Vauxhall Cavalier, Mark One, and she said I could go out in the car. I do remember the first time I drove a car by myself and going down the main road and arriving at the traffic lights at the bottom where the big road crossed over and thinking, wait, and they're green, select first. And it was, I mean, I'm surprised I made it, really. It was so exciting. I learned to fly light aircraft and I went solo, and that was an amazing experience. Mm. But to be brutally honest, it wasn't quite as amazing as the first time you drive a car on your own, because you can't believe you're allowed to do it.
We were speaking about it yesterday, the other day.
So
it's first time you look left and you realize
there's no one there. Yeah.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah. And you are completely responsible. It's sort of slightly terrifying in a way.
Yeah.
But it very, very exciting at the same time. And I can remember, so then I crossed over the main road and then went down into, there was a little village, then up the hill, then I'm in the countryside and I can do a bit of a sort of round robin route of about 5 miles, and then took the car and I was exhausted. I had to go and lie down for several hours. It was amazing, absolutely amazing. So
do you remember your first shunt?
Yes. Oh, hang on. Let me just think what would be... Right, the first shunt where I was driving.
Yeah,
that was actually quite a few years later. I had a series of accidents in friends' cars as a passenger. It became a bit of a habit after a while. But then I actually had one of my own when a bloke I knew, but who wasn't... I just happened to know him by chance. I was driving my dad's car at the time, and I simply stopped to turn right, and he absolutely slammed into the back of it and did quite considerable damage. That was my dad's Rover, and the other guy was in a another Mark III Cortina, actually. I didn't learn the registration number, I'm sorry. But the one on my dad's the one on my dad's Rover was UUG819R. I had to be replaced with DET848V.
And what was that?
That was another Rover. Rover SD1. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, you know, we joke about the registration plates. And as I say, I can remember mine, but we're probably amounting to a grand total of, I don't know, maybe 12 to 15, maybe a few more cars. With you, James, obviously that number must have another digit on it in terms of the amount of cars that have existed within your, you know, your ownership life. I'm not even going to attempt to go through your car history because we'd be here all day, much as actually we'd both enjoy it. But what does the current fleet consist of to give us a little bit of a flavor of where you are with your mix of tastes?
Okay. Well, it's embarrassing because it's actually too many cars. and I'm trying to think which order to do them in. Shall we go woke first or stupid first?
let's go woke first and let's build to stupidity.
Okay. So woke first, I've got a Tesla Model S. Mm-hmm. I have a Toyota Mirai hydrogen fuel cell electric car.
Yeah.
I have a Fiat Panda.
Mm-hmm.
I have an Alpine A110.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I have a Triumph Stag in my garage, but it's not really mine. I'm looking after it for someone, but that's not woke, though, is it? Actually, let's ignore the Stag.
The Stags are cool, but they were always but they always used to break down, though, didn't they? The Stags.
Well, it's a 70s British car, of course.
Yeah. I mean, that's always... that shirt open, chest out medallion, isn't it?
Yeah, standing on the hard shoulder.
Okay, let's ignore the Stag because that's not really mine. So where did I got to with wokeness? Fiat Panda. And I'm on the Alpine A110. Oh, I've got an 88-inch Land Rover Series 3. I have a Land Rover Freelander.
Mm-hmm.
The Alpine A110. A 911 Carrera 2S. A Ferrari 458 Speciale. And... Mm-hmm. Finally, are you ready? A beach buggy.
Oh, have you? I always wanted one of those.
Yeah, it's great.
In like a candy colour?
Oh, yes, it's in metal flake red.
Oh, lovely.
It's bloody fabulous. I mean, it's a terrible car because it's a Beetle, obviously. Yeah. In fact, it's a compromised Beetle because it's shorter and the tyres are too big and it's tail heavy and it's probably technically quite dangerous. But as an artifact or whatever we call it. It's a fantastic, I mean, it just makes me laugh my head off. It's like having a full-size Matchbox supercars or Hot Wheels car. It's just ridiculous.
Have you never fancied popping a 911 engine in it?
Well, I don't...
That really would be dangerous, wouldn't it?
Oh, no, but that's that didn't go right at the top of the pack for the stupid stuff.
No, I know.
It's the one... We did beach buggies for a Grand Tour special and... They got pretty wrecked, obviously, because we drove them across Namibia. And they're not actually that good for using on a beach buggies. It ruins them pretty quickly, all that sand and stuff.
They're not big on sand.
They're really not good on sand. not good digesters of sand. But anyway, we got back to Britain, and mine was, you know, it was pretty ruined. But I said, I'll have the wreckage, because they were ours. They belong, I mean, you know, without being boring, they belong to our production company. But I gave them the money that it was worth. As a bit of a wreck. And then I had the people who had built it originally rebuild it for me. So it's, you know, it has a historical significance. And it's also a correct, in effect, I mean, it's not a real one, but it's a correct Manx beach buggy made with the correct pattern replica bodywork. And it's got the, you know, the basics of the engine are the original Beetle engine. Some of the chassis from the 50s, the floor pan and the main suspension parts and so on. So I thought, I don't want to mess it up. Mm-hmm. If I was going to build another one, if I was suddenly seized with the need for two beach buggies, I'd think seriously about... I mean, I think you can put some flat four Subaru engines in them as well. Which would make it sound great, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's a great engine.
Yeah.
And quite compact. So I think you could have a lot of fun with it. But, I mean, mine's got better brakes and better suspension, better springs and dampers. But the basic sort of steering geometry is still Beetle. And I think if you made it too powerful, it locks up anyway when you brake, you know, because all the weight isn't in the back, it's behind the car. It's sort of following. The engine is in close formation. So I think you'd have to be very careful. But as a thing to just biff around the country lanes, you know, with a bandana on, living, let's be honest, a bit of a fantasy. Mm. It's fantastic. And it's actually quite popular near, I'm talking about where our little hobbit cottage is down in the countryside, but it's quite well known around there. People refer to it as the glitter bug.
Right.
And it's a bit like the local towns. It's almost like a mascot.
Mm.
You know, oh, James's Brilliant. Glitter bug's out. It's parked in the town. You know, that's a nice sign. That means everything's going to be all right. The stupid noddy car's here.
Yeah, it's going to be a good day. I mean, I don't mean give us the location, but presumably the cars don't live with you full time, because that would be one hell of a drive.
Some of them live down in the sticks, mm-hmm. where I have a few garages, and I do have a sort of top secret underground bunker.
Okay,
in London,
with you. Mm.
Which has not just my cars in it, it's got some other people's cars as well, but it's quite close to my house, so I can walk to it.
Got it.
And then the strange thing is, Sarah, my other half, she's not really that interested in cars. But she likes to have one so she can go off independently to buy things from garden centres and go and plant them in our garden and so on, because that's her main hobby. So, but the panda was hers.
Okay.
And I've adopted it, but it was getting a bit clapped out, you know, it's done 120,000 miles or whatever, and she was beginning to feel a bit vulnerable in it. And I said, yeah, you should probably have something a bit more modern. And this is a terrible thing to admit, but it had got to the point in life where I thought, well, I've got to buy Sarah a sensible car because that's what she wants. And it's boring.
Mm.
So I found that the nearest dealer is a VW dealer, or one of the nearest, and cars were in short supply, you know, 6 months ago or so when I bought it. And I ran them out and I said, what have you actually got? Have you got a Polo? And then the bloke said, well, we've got a cancelled order. We've got a basic Polo, which is white with a black interior. It's got no options on it, but it's quite well equipped. It's the 1 litre one. It's a mm-hmm. manual. And I said, oh, I'll have that one.
Mm.
Thinking, right, as you know, in the way that people go to the shops and buy some cornflakes. Like this is an awful thing I'm admitting to. I fully appreciate that. So I don't want your listeners to say that James has turned into a right winger. But anyway, the car was delivered and it's absolutely fantastic.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's fantastic. I mean, it's a 1 litre Polo. It's not quick. It's not exciting, but it works. It's so astonishingly well equipped for a supposedly basic car.
Is that right?
Car. Yeah, it's got connectivity with this, that, and the other. It gives you little messages. It plays tunes. It tells you it's got reversing. And this has got no options on it. This is how it comes.
Mm.
And it's quiet. And it's sort of low burden. And it's just...
Yeah.
I know I'm getting old. I'm 60 now. But I was driving it for the first time. And I was thinking, I'll get rid of everything else and just have
just
this.
Just
have
this that, is actually, yeah.
Because this is
the best car I own.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it reminded me actually why I got into cars in the first place, why I got into writing about cars actually. It's because it's not the car. I mean, supercars are exciting. Fast cars are exciting. Flashy cars, you know, can make you feel wonderful. But the real joy of the car is what it allows you to do. And the basic car not only allows you to do the same thing, i.e. go wherever you want, but it heightens the miracle of it because there's no excess about that car, really. Not by modern standards. It is a car.
An honest little runner. Car.
Yeah. But it's beautiful. I mean, it's superbly made, and it's all these things that it does, and your phone comes up, it's got Apple CarPlay, and it gives you driving tips as you drive. It tells you when to change gear. I tell it to fuck off, but you know, it does it anyway. And it even says things like, eco tip, close window. And I think, no, I just opened it because I wanted it open. But thanks anyway, because that's amazing. You know I've opened the window.
But you know what, James? Jason and I were talking about this the other day, because we are both fathers of 15-year-old daughters. So we're approaching that time where we're starting to worry about, you know, teaching them to drive, or indeed them being on the road, and all these different scary things. But it also, the slightly exciting part of that is that we've both been looking at maybe just getting like a little banger, just like a little runaround. And I'm talking about spending, I don't know, 2, maybe 3 grand tops, but just on something like a little 1 litre thing, either sort of 35 quid tax or zero, you know, no tax and whatnot. But I would imagine that when I do this, I will have the same approach as you. I kind of go, do you know what? It's the best car I've ever had. I love it.
It is.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's the car that I will take to the shops. And that's the car that I'll do all the local journeys rather than lumping my big 3 liter thing around, you know? And I think that's what I will fall in love with.
Have you ever driven, I'm going to think of an example, but there are lots, a Suzuki Solario?
I haven't, no, but it sounds like a lolly.
I've driven one, yes.
And that's a really basic car. It's very boxy. Yes. The interior is very slabby. It's got three cylinder.
Yeah, metallic-y sounding.
Yeah, but I think it's fantastic. And I used to love the Perodua Calisa. Do you remember, you know, the little rounded one from about, best part of 20 years ago. It sort of almost looked like the new Mini should have looked.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
A small thing. And I used to like all those, and the Kia Picanto.
Remember
the old, the old Fiesta. I saw a Mark 1 Fiesta yesterday, weirdly enough, and I looked at it and I thought, wow, I haven't seen one of those for many years. And it's tiny.
Yes.
It's a really tiny little square-cut car. Mm. And I thought, I bet that's brilliant. I bet it's brilliant fun because it's probably the 850 version, and it's really simple. And those simple cars, sort of 1 liter or even a bit less, they're just so immediate. They're sort of almost halfway to being on a bicycle or a moped because you sort of sense everything and you get all the drama of driving, but it's not happening at huge speeds. You don't have to put massive tires on it. It's sort of almost poetic in a way. In fact, yes, everything's going. I'm buying a Polo.
Well,
1 liter.
Do you know, talking about everything going, I mean, do you find it difficult to part with cars? I mean, are you one of those people where does the amount or the fleet for a grand term, does that get larger and larger, or do you try and sell one to get another one, et cetera, and keep them as similar?
Well, I've always tried to operate with
one in,
like
one out
cars
type
or
of policy.
Bikes or even wristwatches. Yeah, one in, one out. But I've obviously failed at that because I didn't always have 9 cars. So I must have gone wrong somewhere. But I don't really. I think by the time you part with the car, you're ready to part. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. And when people say, "Oh, which car did you get rid of that you wish you'd kept?" I don't actually think there is one. I think if you think about it hard, no, you were right to let them go. And could I let all the other ones go? I mean, I do think about this every day, and I sort of slightly lack the courage. You know what? I'm going to be really honest with you now because I'm at the sort of age where I can be. So I've got an orange Ferrari with gold wheels, and it's a truly wonderful thing, and I love it. It's fascinating, but I don't drive it that often. I took it out the other day for a bit of a spin, and that was the first time I've been away filming. So that was the first time for 3 or 4 months that I'd even taken the cover off it. And I've done it. I've had several Ferraris and Porsches and things, and I'm sure I've got it out of my system. I could let it go, but there's a tiny bit of you think people won't find me interesting anymore because I haven't got an orange Ferrari. I mean, let's be honest, people my age only have Ferraris because they're worried that women aren't interested in them anymore. That's the honest truth. So is it like an admission of defeat? I better get rid of the Ferrari.
Nobody's well, is it is orange, to be fair.
Yeah, but orange is great.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been a fan
I like the
of
way you
red
picked on the
red
orange, not
yeah,
the
well, exactly. Oh, well, I know. Now you do mention the wheels.
Yes, it's orange.
Do you know what? I've never really liked a bright red Ferrari. I've always preferred like them in blue or grey.
Well, interestingly, when I bought it, I set off determined to have one in the, not Tour de France blue, the dark one. I can't remember what it's called in the Ferrari colours. I used to know all these by heart.
Yeah.
I thought I'll have that, but I will have the gold wheels because that'll look quite classy. And then I went to they have at Ferrari, they have a big version of the online configurator.
Yeah,
Atelier. Yeah, exactly, the Atelier. And you actually sit inside the car effectively while you're fit, and it's fantastic. And I just tried the orange and I thought, do you know, I'm only ever going to buy a brand new limited edition Ferrari once in my life.
Sod it,
I'm having an orange one. So I got the orange. But it is ridiculous. And I do feel a bit of a burk driving around in it, if I'm honest. I'd never bring it to London.
You've got to be in the mood to drive them, haven't you? You've really got to be up and in the move. Otherwise, they're a bit too flashy, aren't they?
They are a bit. So
what's the thoughts on electric then, James?
Well, I understand the love for internal combustion because it is fascinating and it does give cars character, and the character actually comes from the flaws in the system because, you know, engines have to be managed. The fact that they need to idle, that they have peaks and troughs in the delivery, you need a gearbox, you know, that's actually what makes them interesting to us.
Yes.
But in reality, electric cars, as we've known for at least 100 years, make sense because it's, you know, clean, quiet, low maintenance, easier to drive, blah, blah, blah. But I think having experimented with them for, I mean, I've had an electric car since 2014, so almost 10 years.
Yeah.
It's not quite right.
No.
Because when I analyze it to myself, and I've got absolutely nothing else to think about, the battery technology isn't actually good enough. The batteries are amazing compared with when we were kids or when the Sinclair C5 came out. There were still only lead acid batteries.
Yeah.
In effect, and milk floats had those. And the early electric cars, you know, back in America in 1910 had those as well. But the lithium ion battery is an amazing thing, but it's still not good enough for a car because even with the rapid charges, it takes too long. I know all the arguments for it. You do regular journeys, you top up at home at night. That's all true. But if you actually want to use the car to go around the country because you, I mean, nobody sells encyclopedias anymore, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
sort of thing. It simply doesn't work.
Yeah.
And people keep trying to kid themselves that it do, but we have to be honest about it. It needs another quite massive leap in battery technology, or we also have to look at things like hydrogen or synthetic fuels.
Yeah.
Synthetic fuels. Yeah.
When I look into synthetic fuels, and I remember doing this years and years ago with a science show I was making for the BBC, I went to Albuquerque in, that's New Mexico, isn't it?
Yep.
To a solar farm where they were pioneers in this, but they were effectively using the solar energy to A, crack the hydrogen out of water, and also run pumps that extracted the carbon part of it out of the air. That, you know, those are the two basic ingredients. And they got as far as making ethanol, which I think is the simplest of the hydrocarbons. That's the simplest chain.
Yes.
And we made enough of it on this day. And I'm talking about like half an espresso cup. And we put it into a little model aeroplane that we were able to fly around to demonstrate that, yes, you can make fuel this way. And it's come on a long way since then, because that was a good 15 years ago. But I still feel it's going to be a boutique fuel because it's going to be
expensive.
It's going to be expensive because you simply have to shift such a lot of material to extract it. So, I mean, in an ideal world, in the way that we, you know, currently have petrol diesel and petrol and diesel hybrids, I don't see why we couldn't have hydrogen fuel cells, especially if things like lorry and bus fleets embrace it. The cars can piggyback on the back. It's not the solution to just the car. It has to be a bigger picture thing. So we could have some of that. We could have some hydrogen combustion, which will work in turbines and so on. A lot of people would be able to live with a battery electric car because they actually only ever make regular journeys and they're quite short. And we'd be able to, the enthusiasts would be able to have their orange Ferraris or their old Dodge Vipers or whatever with the synthetic fuel, which they'll happily pay more for because they're only going to use them as a treat. And what's the other thing we can have that I just thought of? No, that was it. We can have four things. So we can have battery electric, hydrogen fuel cell electric, combustible hydrogen combustion, and synthetic fuels. We don't have to choose one. We can have several.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah. And sort of adopt a mix of all different things, you know, to actually sort of, you know, cope with the array of vehicles that we're trying to power, aren't we, you know?
Yeah, and it's not just cars. Obviously, you need to think about things like aviation and shipping.
Yeah, of course.
But what would you put your money on of those four?
Do you know what? I would want to put my money on e-fuel, actually, I think, synthetic fuel.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think primarily because the infrastructure is just there. So it's just about cracking that nut and trying to mass produce and bring the cost down. Cost of production, because then you haven't got to dig in, you've not got to dig infrastructure in, which you would have to do for hydrogen.
Yeah,
and electric as well.
But also, presumably, you would just be able to, with some kind of minor conversion, all of the traditional petrol powered cars now would operate on synthetic fuels, would they not, with a conversion?
I'm not even sure you need a conversion.
I don't think you need
five. No, specify the fuel, right? It should work straight away.
Yeah. Which, you know, in itself, actually, when you think about it, is a far more green solution. Sorry, that's someone at the door. Is a far more green solution than actually just junking all of this, you know, sort of historical metal when you could actually keep it going.
Yes, well, that there is a case for that, and it's a very good argument. The green, the answer to the green issue is never is never simple. It's never a one-step thing. I'm worried that that person at the door might be someone who's
able
to remember your dad's number plate.
It's fine. It'll be an Amazon delivery, and my daughter's downstairs. It'll all be taken care of.
But I'll tell you what is the really difficult nut to crack, and that is shipping and aviation. Yes.
Aviation is very difficult, and
I don't see that ever being battery because there's just not the energy density in a battery, nowhere near. So I think that has to be some sort of e-fuel.
Or combustible hydrogen.
But ships, Christ, what are they going
to
do?
That's a lot of juice, isn't it, to get those across the oceans.
Some people are saying sails. There are still people who advocate sails.
Yeah.
Because they can be made so much more efficient than they could in the 18th century.
What do you reckon a big cargo bulk carrier container ship does in terms of knots? What do you reckon it does? 20 knots, maybe?
Yeah,
max?
I would have thought. Yeah, not much more than that.
I'm wondering if because the original clipper. The clippers of old, they were 25 knots, weren't they? And they were antiques. So I wonder, actually, there might be something in that.
Oh, well, I remember reading about it as a kid it was something like Speed and Power magazine had an article about sailing ships of the future, which had these very high-tech, I suppose they'd be carbon fibre now, sails, rather than a lot of stuff flapping around and rigging. It had like just straightforward rigid poles. So no tars running up into the crow's nest or any of that stuff. It was just computer-controlled sails. I remember looking at it thinking, well, yeah, it's quite windy at sea. Why not?
Well, it sounds like maybe, James, the subject of another book for you, James May, God, Marvelous Sailing Vehicles or something like that, to move on from what you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, so we've done human-powered vehicles, and then we have to have sort of nature-powered vehicles.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. Well, there you go. There's another book sorted. I'm conscious that we're running out of time. I have two more questions, one from me and one from Jason, very quickly, if we may.
Go on then, yes.
James, if you were to pick one car and one only from all of the vehicles that you've owned over the years and stick with it for the rest of your life, which one would it be and why?
Yes, okay, let's say of the one, so if somebody comes around tomorrow and says, I'm taking all your cars, you can keep one.
Yeah.
It's one of those.
Yeah.
I would keep the Alpine.
Oh,
interesting.
That's a stupid idea. It's got the world's most pathetic luggage space, as you probably know. You can get like a copy of the Beano and a sandwich in it. Yeah. But I don't generally carry much stuff about, and I can always put it in Sarah's Polo. I'm using that as a get-out. Mm. But I think the remarkable thing about that car, and it's very underrated to me, is that it's the engineering is intelligent because it's been done. It's the core of it has the thinking in it, i.e. it's a bit smaller than a supercar. It's lighter. It only has a 1.8-litre engine, and it develops, mine's the original one, 246 horsepower, which doesn't sound like a lot, but because it's small, it is plenty.
Yeah.
And then the tyres are smaller and the wheels are smaller, and it actually adds up into what people think is a sports car, but is actually a downsized supercar. It's shrunk by 20%. And I think it's not a cheap car. Mm. But it's a lot cheaper than a McLaren. And in terms for the amount of actual driving satisfaction you get for the money, and I'm including, the cost of new tyres, the insurance, the fuel bill, the road tax, all that sort of stuff, it's absolutely remarkable. Mm. And in many ways, I think it might be the best car I've ever owned.
Wow. Wow, that's very interesting. I love it. I think they're great to drive. Really great car.
They're fantastic. And they have a slight... This is car bore stuff now, but they have a slight quality of older 911 about them in that the front end is a little bit skittish.
Yes,
I think actually you could get yourself into a lot of trouble in that car if you weren't careful because it's slightly deceptive.
Yeah.
And it'll do that, you accelerate out of a roundabout and there's that slight front end. You know what I mean? I'm not expressing it very well.
I know exactly what you mean.
Exactly like you get in an old 911, an old air cooled 911.
It just wanders around a bit.
Yeah. It's very controllable, but it's...
Yeah.
To someone used to driving, say, a front drive hot hatch or something like that, it would feel a little bit,
a bit odd.
A little bit delicate almost. Yeah. But I love it. I think, in fact, I'm going to get it out this weekend because I haven't driven that for a few weeks either. Right, everything's going except that and the beach buggy.
Well, perfect choice. So, This is a question we ask all our guests because we generally believe that music and motoring go particularly well to get together. So we want a fantasy drive. We want to know where you are, where you're going, what you're listening to, and most importantly, what are you in?
Okay.
And this can be anywhere.
Mm.
Or anything.
Oh. And you're allowed to borrow Sarah's polo if you want.
Yeah, the Bluetooth system is extremely good. I think I'm going to take the Alpine, actually.
Yeah.
Given everything I've just said, how could I not?
Mm. Yeah.
But where shall I go? Now, do I want to go somewhere scenic, very drivable, or exotic? I.e., do I want to drive through the West Country of England, which I very much like doing, for the scenery? Do I want to go maybe somewhere like Albania for the fabulous roads?
Yeah.
Very nice roads and not too busy. Mm-hmm. Or do I want to drive through somewhere like Japan because it's fabulous to look at and it's, you know, everything about it is a bit of a mystery.
Yeah, and Jason will cover your fantasy shipping costs anyway to get the vehicle.
Oh, okay. Right, so that gets the car anywhere I want to be. God, that's quite difficult. We haven't even got to the music yet. I'm going to make a quick snap decision. I'm going to drive my car around the island of Kyushu in Japan.
Nice.
There you go. And I'm going to take the Alpine. And I'm going to listen to... Doesn't feel like a sort of classical music event. It could be jazz, or it could just be straightforward rock and roll. Sod it. I'll take the complete AC/DC.
Perfect. And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Well, sadly, that is it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, huge thanks to you, but a massive thanks to our very special guest this week, the one and only Mr. James May. Thank you, mate.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
No, thoroughly enjoyed that. We could have talked for hours and hours. James's book, James May, Marvellous Vehicles, is out now. Don't forget, as always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time. Ta-da.